Good evening. About 6 years ago, Jennifer and I had gone to New York City for our 10th anniversary. We spent a week there, and the most impressive part of the trip to me was a little boat ride we took on a Circle Line cruise around Manhattan Island. And the best part of that was when we went by the Statue of Liberty. That was the most spectacular thing about the trip for me. Not just to see that statue, which is a symbol of our country and of some of the privileges and freedoms that we, blessings that we enjoy. But because of my connection with that, we went to Ellis Island the next day, and there's a little place there where you can do some family research. They've got a computer you can rent for about 15 minutes and look up a relative. And so I plugged in the computer there the name Raymond Vandeweghe, who was my great-grandpa on my mother's side. And there was a hit, and brought up a page that had a ship manifest when Raymond Vandeweghe came in the 1920s to New York City through Ellis Island. He had left Belgium and had come here as an immigrant, and had left a wife and a child back in Belgium. His father was a baker. He was a baker. He was not a baker when he came to this country. He painted houses. And he brought his family to a new world. He didn't speak the language. He had just a little bit of money in his pocket, enough to get a train ride to the Missouri area, where he began making a new life for himself and for his family. His wife would come later. And that made the trip extra special, to be standing on a boat in the harbor there, looking at what would have been a sight for him when he came to the city, and trying to think about what he must have been thinking, and what fears he must have had, and what anxieties about this new trek he was making in life, and the uncertainties of the future, the uncertainties of the past, and what all this was going to mean for his family. But I must say that I'm an admirer of that kind of courage, that is, that launches out, that dares to dream about what the future might hold. But even more than the Raymond Vandeweghes and your parentage and grandparentage and your forefathers that made similar kinds of choices to make a new way for your family and for their progeny, I'm an admirer of the Abrahams and Isaacs and Jacobs and Sarahs and Rebeccas and Rachels, and all of those down through our spiritual heritage who made a decision not just to leave an old world for a new world, but to leave the world altogether for the city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God, because they were people that believed in things eternal. And I admire you for that reason, because you're a people who've decided to leave the world, this world, for something better. And to make this world, to what extent we can, by our influence and by what God has given us because of His grace and His gifts, to touch as many people as we can to want to leave too, and to make the march, the trek to Zion, to the glorious city that God has fashioned for people who love Him more than they love life. And I am glad to be a part of that pilgrimage and to be with you this week as we think about those kinds of holy, noble, otherworldly things and themes that make us long for our ultimate destination and make us more motivated and more committed while we're here to live a walk by faith. And so thank you for being a part of what we're doing today and this week, and for what you're doing here in this region to recommend the gospel to your neighbors and to one another by the way that you live. Nehemiah chapter 3 tonight, please. Nehemiah chapter 3, if you'll open there. I want to read together the first 12 verses of this text. Nehemiah chapter 3, verses 1 through 12. It's names, the names that we read here. And please consider the reading carefully from Nehemiah chapter 3. Then Eliashib, the high priest, arose with his brothers, the priest, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall to the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananel. And next to him, that is next to Eliashib, the men of Jericho built, and next to them Zakur, the son of Imri, built. Now the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate. They laid its beams, and they hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, made repairs. And next to him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. Next to him, Zadok, the son of Baana, also made repairs. Moreover, next to him, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the work of their masters. Now Joiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshulam, the son of Basadeah, repaired the old gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars. And next to them, Melatiah the Gibeonite and Jadon the Meronothite, the men of Gibeon and of Mizpah, also made repairs for the official seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to him, Aziel, the son of Harhiah, of the goldsmiths, made repairs. And next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, made repairs, and they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Raphiah, the son of Hur, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. Next to them, Jediah, the son of Haramoth, made repairs opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of Hashabniah, made repairs. Melchijah, the son of Haram, and Hashab, the son of Peath Moab, repaired another section in the Tower of the Furnaces. And next to him, Shalem, the son of Halohesh, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs, he and his daughters. If you're in the habit of doing some kind of daily Bible reading through the Bible in a year, when you come to a section like Nehemiah chapter 3, or you come to the opening sections of 1 Chronicles and texts like that where there are genealogies or list of names, those are places that we sometimes don't do justice to. We sometimes skip over sections like this. One of the reasons why is because the names are just hard to say. The secret to that is just to say them with confidence, because nobody else knows how to say them either. So when you say them like you know how to pronounce them, then you look like you know something when nobody else knows how to say them either. But there's more to it than that. These are names of real people. These are not fictitious. This was just like Raymond Vandeweghe. This is somebody's parents and somebody's great-grandparents and great-grandparents that returned to Jerusalem. They, at some point in time, they meant something to people, because somebody who had come back to the city of Jerusalem in the 300s or the 200s or in the time of Jesus could look back and say, that was my great-great-great-great-granddaddy and grandmother who did that. Shalem was, he was an ancestor of mine, and his daughters, they were my cousins, and so these names meant something to people at some place in time. But even more than having meant something to people that were their descendants, these names meant something to God, and that's the reason why they're in God's book, because these are not just a list of names. They're a list of people who were in their time, in their day, in a place and time in history. They were people who were committed to God. These are all the names of committed persons. They're all people who didn't have to come back to the city of Jerusalem. They are people who left perhaps a comfortable existence that they were now beginning to hew out for themselves in the distant lands to which the Babylonians had taken them when the city was destroyed. These were people who were now residents of other places. And so they uprooted their families, not because they had to, but because they wanted to, and because they were committed to the purposes of God in their time. And so they made this trek from what was for them home to what was now going to be a land that many of them had never seen. They came there to rebuild the walls of the city, to restore the city of Jerusalem, so that the purposes and prophecies that God had made through prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and others, that the promises and purposes of God could be fulfilled. Some of these people paved the way for the coming of John the Baptist and for the coming of Jesus for the redemption of Jerusalem. And these people played a role in that great drama because they were committed to the purposes of God in their time. So they are honorable persons. And here is an honor roll that God has left in our book to remember these people to us and their great model of what it means to be committed to God, of committed individuals. Just even a casual reading of the list of names indicates that they were committed people. For instance, in verse 2, we read about the men of Jericho. Here are men that didn't live in the city of Jerusalem, but who come from Jericho to Jerusalem to work on the building of the wall. Here are people who are laboring for a cause that is not going to do them any personal good. It's for the good of other people. That's an honorable way. When you make sacrifices for a cause that's not going to benefit you personally because you don't even live in the city in this case, but is going to benefit other people because you believe in the cause. That's an honorable way. And so the men of Jericho are regarded and remembered because they did good things that would benefit other people. The Tekoites, in verse 5, are people who were not supported by their superiors. It says that their superiors did not support, or their nobles did not support the work of their masters, in verse 5. And so here are people who are laboring in a cause even though their own people oppose them. And so they're laboring for a cause and are not swayed by the, or intimidated by the politics of the situation, because they believe in the work that they're doing. And down in verse 7, there's a fellow named Melatiah, the Gibeonite, and Jadon, the Meronothite. And they are doing the work, and it's a work that's sponsored by somebody else. And so they're doing the work or making the repairs for the official seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. If these men are working and the governor beyond the river is sponsoring their work, if a plaque were put on the wall to remember this portion and who the contributors were, would the plaque have the name of the laborers or would it have the name of the governor? It's likely going to be the sponsor that is remembered. And so here are men who are laboring for a cause and are willing to give somebody else the credit for the work that they do, even though they provided the sweat equity, the labor force behind the work that was being done. Azael the goldsmith and Hananiah the perfumer, down in verse 8, are men that are laboring in a field outside of their expertise. They are not masons. They are goldsmiths and perfumers, but they're doing the work along with everyone else. In verse 9, Raphaiah is an official of the half-district of Jerusalem. Here's a man who's a politician, and yet he's rolling up his sleeves along with everyone else. Here is a politician. Here is a man who is in charge of people, and yet he's working along with everyone else. He's doing work that's beneath him, but he doesn't treat it as if it's beneath him in some way. Melchijah, the official of the district of Beth-Hakkerem, in verse 14, we didn't read about him, but he was the man that worked on the refuse gate. Here's a man that's willing to do the work that's beneath everybody. He's willing to work on the gate where they take out the trash, where the dumping ground for the city. And all of that speaks of an honorable people who were committed persons and their time. Now, I don't expect when the lesson's over with tonight that you're going to remember these names, that they're going to be branded on your memory. But I hope they'll be a little more familiar to you. And regardless of whether or not you remember anyone's name that's here, I hope you'll remember that these were honorable people, committed people in their time, and that you'll be not just an admirer of their example, but that you'll be an imitator. Because the same things that made them committed in their time, and the same things to which they were committed to, the same principles, are the kinds of things that we need to be committed to in our time, as people who have the opportunity to participate in God's purpose for us in our day, wherever we live, and wherever we are, and whatever our station in life. We have opportunities that are similar to the opportunities that face these people in their day. Could I make a few observations about their commitment? The first is very obvious. Here in Nehemiah chapter 3, we're introduced to a people that work together. They're people that work together. Is that not obvious? They were working together on this great project of restoring the walls of Jerusalem. Have you ever built a rock wall? There are lots of rock walls, I've noticed, around this region of the country. Have you ever constructed something out of rock? It's hard work building walls. I have not built rock walls. I've put up a lot of fences in East Tennessee. We had a lot of farms around there, a lot of people with cattle, and so I got to string some barbed wire and dig some fence post holes and drive in some stakes and all that sort of thing. And fence building, I want to tell you, is hard work. Wrestling with fence posts and driving stakes and digging with post hole diggers and stringing barbed wire and all, mending fences, all of that, that's hard work. It's hard labor. And I imagine that building rock walls is even more challenging kind of labor, particularly when it is a defensive kind of bulwark. It's not just to keep the cows in. It's not just to keep the wolves out. It's to keep the enemies out that have battering rams and that have archers and that have that are wanting to slay the residents of the city. So this is difficult work that they were all involved in, and everything that's involved in any kind of manual labor and the strenuousness of it, all of that would have been a part of this venture too. So there would have been blisters, and there would have been calluses, and there would have been aching backs in this labor effort. And there, somebody would have got sunburned because they, for 52 days solid, were working on the wall. And somebody would have bashed their toe or their thumb or gotten some kind of injury as they were working on the wall, and there would have been scrapes and cuts and aching muscles and sometimes disagreements about how the wall ought to proceed and what would be the best strategy for fixing this portion of the wall. So all the things that went on with any kind of labor-intensive work would have been a part of this construction effort too. But they worked together at it in spite of those difficulties. If building walls is difficult, if labor is difficult, I want to suggest to you there's a work that's far more difficult than that, and it is the work that we are all about. It is the most challenging kind of work that you can ever be involved in, and it is people work. There is no work that is more difficult, that requires more patience, that requires more forbearance, more long-suffering, more love, more forgiveness, more tolerance of injury than when we're working together with people. And we are a part of a great construction effort that is going on with us individually as God is shaping our life by His Word and by our submission to it and by what we do for each other in edification. Do you see in edification a relation to the word edifice? What you do is you build something, and God is building something with us. 1 Peter talks about how we are all spiritual stones, and that God is taking us and He's building us into a spiritual house for worship to Him. We are all a part of a temple, and we are all individually stones in that temple. And so all of those great images of building and of construction are a part of the images that God employs when He talks about what we are as a people. And there is going to be difficulty in the construction work that we are about, because you can't do with a brother or a sister the same way that you can do with a piece of rock that won't fit where it's supposed to. You cannot just knock a chip off of someone's shoulder the same way that you can do a piece of stone in order to try to shove it into place. And so we have all kinds of differences in personalities. We have different things about us that are oblique or that don't fit just right or that need to be shaped or reformed in some kind of way. And God expects us to work together so that we fit together, so that we grow together, so that we build together in our lives individually and corporately in the body. We build something that really glorifies Him, that esteems the values that God esteems, that magnifies His majesty, that magnifies His purpose, that makes it something that to our community and to our world is appealing so that people want to be a part of this thing that we're building that glorifies God in our time. Nehemiah's workers are a great tribute to the fact that we can work together, that it can be done, and that it's worth doing. And God has given us a work that we need to be doing together, and we have great reason to do that because our reward is even more majestic and even more meaningful to us because of what we've come to see that Nehemiah's people didn't even begin to envision about the glorious purpose that God had in mind in Christ. Look at the fourth chapter of Nehemiah and a few verses about the challenge of the work that Nehemiah and his men were involved in. In Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 16, it says, "And it came about that from that day on, that half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, the breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand doing the work, and the other holding a weapon." This construction effort was not the work of some kind of parks and rec committee in the city of Jerusalem. This was not a beautification effort to just make the city look pretty as they were rebuilding the walls. These walls were defensive. It turns out that there were lots of enemies that were still around and who liked to see the fact that Jerusalem had been decimated by the Babylonians, and were content for it to remain that way. Just over a couple hills away, in fact, we read, if we were to look further into the book of Nehemiah, there were two major enemies, a man named Sanballat and a man named Tobiah, and they were conspiring against the people of Jerusalem as they were building the city, trying to find ways that they could discourage them. And so there were threats And there were letters written and all kinds of correspondence to the king and all kinds of efforts to try to discourage the work that was going on there. And so Nehemiah had to organize his workers so that they were prepared, if need be, to turn from their construction efforts to engage in a defensive battle. So they carried their trowel in one hand, and in the other hand they carried a sword. Or they were wheeling a wheelbarrow, but they had their bow and arrow on their back. I mean, they were prepared for battle at any time because their lives were at risk in this work that they were about. Now, what kind of wall are you going to build if you know that the wall is going to keep the enemy away from your house and away from your family? And this is the wall that's going to protect you. I mean, you're motivated to work together when you know that your life depends on the work that you're doing. 1 John chapter 3, verse 14, John writes, "We know that we passed out of death into life because we love the brethren. He who does not love abides in death. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us." That's Jesus. "And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth." The work that we're about is so much more important than the work that Nehemiah and his workers were about. Their lives depended on the work that they were doing, but brothers and sisters, souls depend upon the work that we're doing. And that is reason for us to work together. It is reason for us to be committed to God's work in our time. It is reason why we are patient with each other and why we're forbearing and why we're loving and why we're forgiving and why we go out of the way to bind the body together and why we go out of the way to rescue those that are in trouble spiritually. Why we go out of our way to find souls that are looking and to make a difference in their life by the way that we live our life, by the way that we shine our light, by the way that we try to teach, by the way that we try to model Christianity. There is reason for us to be committed to the work that we're about because souls depend upon the work that we're doing. So we don't love in just word. We love in deed and in truth. We've got to be committed to one another's souls, to one another's best interest. I grew up in a little congregation in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. My folks were converted when I was 8 years old. I'll never forget the night that Mom and Dad went down the aisle together to obey the gospel. It was a life-changing event, it was, for our family when my folks became Christians. And we had a lot of growing up to do, and we grew as a family, our family did, in the Lord. And brethren there were so patient with us. There was a fellow that sat on the very back row whose name was John Young. John Young was a big man. Everything about him was thick. He had thick hands, he had thick arms, he had a thick face, he had fat lips. Everything about him was just thick. He wore thick glasses that made his eyes really large. And John was an intimidating kind of character. He was a man that just was blunt about everything that he did. I said, everything about him was thick, even the way he dealt with people. We didn't have an eldership there. We had business meetings where the men would discuss the needs of the church. And John was a man who just had a way of, he could say three sentences and make everybody mad in a business meeting. There were some things about him that were not good, but he was a man who loved the Lord and who was convicted. He sat on the back row, and I sat one Wednesday night in the pew in front of him next to a friend, and we played the entire service. I mean, all Wednesday night, we played. Now, we didn't do so in a big way. We thought we were being so clever and so quiet, but John Young saw. I led the closing prayer that Wednesday night after playing the whole service. First time I ever led a prayer. Came to the front, said the prayer, started to walk out the back door, and John Young came behind me, walking with his cane, and he grabbed me by the nape of the neck, and he turned me around. And John Young pointed that big, thick finger in my face, and he said, "Young man, I want you to know that the church of the Lord is no place for you to play." I went out the door, and I was so mad. I went and I got in the car, turned the radio on, and I thought to myself, that mean old man, who does he think he is? He's not my daddy. He's not my granddaddy. He doesn't have any right to say that sort of thing to me. Who does he think he is? Well, it took me a long time. In fact, I was in college, I reckon, before I figured out what gave John Young the right to say that to me. You see, that mean old man that pointed his thick finger in my face loved me. He loved me enough to make this little whippersnapper of a boy mad when I played in church. And I love him for loving me enough to say what he said to me. Now, I know that sometimes we say things too hard to one another. And I know that sometimes we say things too quick and sometimes too sharp, sometimes too long. But you know, sometimes we don't say enough either. And sometimes we need to be blunt. And sometimes we need to be forward. But I tell you something else. Your neighbors don't care if you lose your soul. Probably the people that you work with are not thinking about whether or not you're going to heaven or not. And this culture is not going to be looking to reinforce family values for you so that you can raise godly children who love the Lord and who love the Lord's things. And I need a people who love me enough, who are going to come and talk to me when my soul's in trouble. I need a people who will run the risk of upsetting me, of making me angry. Not because that's their objective, but because they really love me and care about my soul enough that they'll tell me that I need help, that I need to make a change. Because there isn't anyone in this world that's going to do it if you don't do that for me. And if I don't do that for you, we're not going to get any help from our community, from our cities, from our neighbors. We're not going to get any help from our officials, from our governors, from our presidents. And so we're all we got. And so we've got to look out for one another's souls. Now, I need people that love me enough that are going to do the kind of work that I need most, which is that kind of spiritual edification and building up. And so it's so critical that we do that for one another. I've discovered since that time that when a well-meaning brother or sister says to me, Brother Moore, I need to talk to you about something. And then they tell me something that is not pleasant to hear, that's by way of correction or rebuke or admonition. You know what I've learned since that time? I still don't like it. I still don't like it. I'd still rather not hear that kind of thing. But you know what? I understand it now, and I need it. I need it. Because it's a part of God's plan. It's a part of what I need. And God has given us the privilege of being among a people who love each other enough to tell each other what we really need. And so souls depend upon the work that we're doing. And that means that we need to treat the work that we do and one another very soberly and very seriously, because Jesus Christ died not just to purchase our pardon. He died to purchase our unity. Every soul here is blood bought. That's how much it meant to God, and it needs to mean that much to us. We don't regard the blood of Jesus as something that's cheap, as something that is... it is precious, and that means that every soul that's been bought by His blood is precious too. And so I need to regard it with that kind of seriousness. So there are people that work together. There are people that work together because their lives depended on it. Souls depended upon the work that we're doing. We need to work together in the same way. The work that they were about in Nehemiah chapter 3 was the work of repairing. Did you notice how often the word repair occurs in the text? It says in verse 2 that next to him the men of Jericho built in verse 4. It says, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakos, made repairs. Next to him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, of Meshezabel, made repairs. On and on it talks about how the work that they were doing was the work of repairing. Construction work is hard, but reconstruction work is harder. Construction work, new construction is hard, but renovation work, reformation work, restoration work, if you've done any of that, where you're taking old materials and new materials and trying to blend them together, it's a lot harder than just starting from the ground, starting from scratch. And that's the kind of work that they're doing. You see, there were bricks that were burned, and there was stuff that needed to be, materials that needed to be salvaged, and some that just needed to be hauled off and thrown away because it wasn't any good anymore. But you had to get rid of the rubble so that you could start building again. And you had to blend some of the old with some of the new that you had to haul in. And they had to do all of this in a hurry. And that's hard work. And that's the kind of work that we're about. That is the kind of work that we are doing. We're involved in the work of restoring. We're involved in the work of reforming. We're involved in the work of renewing. Because we all bring a sack of rocks to this work that God has given us to do. I mean, we have baggage from our past. We have things in our lives that need to be changed. We have things about our character that we're trying to reform. And all of us are doing this together. We are an imperfect people that are all under construction, and we are all helping each other with this construction effort. And it is hard work, this kind of work that we're doing, because it is the work of a lifetime. You're not going to get done when you're 35 years old, or when you're 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 years old. This is a lifetime work, this process of growing up into Christ, growing to maturity. And sometimes we can lose our optimism in that. Sometimes we get weary. Sometimes we get tired in this work of restoring and renewing and growing up. I love bicycles. I like to ride bicycles. I don't do enough of it, but I enjoy it anyway. And one of the things I love about the bicycle is just what an efficient machine it is for transportation. I mean, you take a little cog, and you put teeth on, you know, it has teeth on it, and you've got a big one up here, and the small one's attached to the back wheel, and the front one's attached to where your pedals are, and there's a tie that binds the two of these together, a chain. And so when you pedal the big chain ring up front, it turns the little gear in the back that turns the wheel and makes it go. And when you turn the big chain ring faster, the big gear faster, it turns the little gear faster, and so you go faster. And when you turn the big gear slower, the little one slows down, and it slows down. And when you stop the big gear, the little gear stops, and the whole thing stops. And it's a very efficient transfer of energy from the most efficient kind of machine, the human body, to a very efficient contraption, a machine that goes, and it takes you faster than you could go if you're walking. I want to suggest to you that our commitment to God needs to be that simple. I fear that some of the reason why we lose our optimism is because we lose our motivation. We forget what makes us go. You see, the Lord is what makes everything in our life run, or He's what ought to make everything in our life run. We have this connection between us and Him. And there's this tie that binds us together of trust in Him and His promises and His commandments. So that when the Lord says go, we go, because we believe that He knows that we ought to go and how fast we ought to go. And when the Lord says slow here, we slow here because of the tie that binds us to Him. And when the Lord says stop, we stop because we know that He has our best interest at heart. And so you see, there is that simple tie that binds us together to Him that just runs everything in our life. But part of what can cause us to lose our optimism as a people is that our relationship to God can become a lot more complicated than that. So that rather than just a simple connection between us and God, it looks more like this. Here we are, and here the Lord is, but there are other factors in our life. So there's our health here, and here's our finances, and here's our marriage, and here's our relationship to our brethren. And so rather than a simple tie that binds us to the Lord, it looks more like this. You see, there are all these other factors now that all impact our relationship to God. So that everything is okay between me and God, so long as everything is okay with my health. And so long as everything is good with my finances. And so long as everything is good with my wife. And so long as everything is good with the brethren. But if one of those things breaks down, look at how vulnerable our relationship with the Lord is. If something goes wrong with my health, or something goes wrong with my job, or something, or there's a little bit of rockiness in the marital relationship, or there is some kind of breach between me and a brother, and suddenly I not only quit the brother or quit the marriage or quit the job or have some other kind of dysfunction in my life, but I quit the Lord. And what sense does that make? What sense does that make when I make everything else in my life a contingency for my relationship with God? You see, it ought to be that my relationship with the Lord is what drives everything else in my life, rather than everything else in my life driving my relationship with God. It ought to be that the way that I handle the crises that come in my life flow from the relationship and the confidence that I have in God. That everything's going to be okay, and that I'm going to trust in Him, and I'm going to be committed to Him regardless of whatever. And that my relationships, I'm going to behave the way that I ought to because the Lord is worthy of that. And because I trust in His promises that if I love my neighbor, if I love my wife, if I love my brother in a way that is in a way that they don't even deserve, that that's the best way to bring about good change in the world. That's the way God loved me, and so I just believe it works. And so keeping our motivation is a matter of keeping our relationship with God simple, so that we're committed to Him no matter what. And that equips us then for every other commitment in life, because we trust in His promises and His commitment to us. So we have this difficult work that God has called us to do. But it's a work that we're equipped to do because God has equipped us. He empowers us. He gives us the strength. He gives us the drive to do what we need to do because we trust in His promises. I love the fact that it says concerning these people that they work next to each other. Look at verse 2. Where it says next to him, that is next to Eliashib the priest, the men of Jericho were building. And if we were to read down through the text, look at verse 4. Next to them, Meremoth. Next to him, Zadok. Next to him, verse 5, the Tekoites. And so on and so on. It talks about how they labored next to each other. I love what that says about the unity of this community. That they labored next to each other. Visualize this. It's early Monday morning. And all the campfires are burning. The sun's not come up yet. And it's a brisk morning. And somebody comes up and they're boiling some water for coffee. And the men are yawning and they're stretching and they've got all these sore backs from the work the day before. And so they all come out and they start gathering around the campfires and they're straggling a bit because they've been at this work for 2 weeks or so. And here comes Nehemiah, and he strides across the camp confidently, and he's got the blueprints over his shoulder, and he brings them, and they lay them out on a table, and all the supervisors gather around, and they're all sipping their coffee, and they're talking about what portion of the wall they're going to work on today. And another one of the workers is over there, and he's they've got a great big frying pan, and he's over there scrambling some eggs, and somebody else is cooking some bacon, and they're maybe not bacon, but whatever. Whatever it is that they would have eaten for their breakfast meat. And when the breakfast is over and the assignments have been made, everybody picks up their hoe and they pick up their trowel and they get their pick and they get their shovel and somebody's got the wheelbarrow and they all go out to the wall together. And you can look at the gate, the sheep gate, and there Eliashib is. And you can look over at the refuse gate and there is Malachijah. And you can look all along the wall, north and south and east and west throughout the day as Nehemiah maybe stops to mop his brow and to look around the city. And what he sees is a city of people that are stirring up dust. They are next to each other. And everybody's working. And somebody else is coming along and they've got the watering bucket and they're giving a drink, refreshment to all of these men. And everybody's got their sleeves rolled up and they're all working together and they're next to each other. Isn't that a beautiful picture? As the sun comes up and God smiles on a city of people that are committed to Him and are committed to each other and they're carrying their sword and they're carrying their tools and they're all laboring together in His work. That's a beautiful picture. Do your brothers and sisters know that about you? Do they know that you're next to them? and that you're going to be, no matter what. That we're all stirring up dust in the Lord's cause. And we're optimistic about it. We believe in what God has called us to do. We believe in the effectiveness of His plans. And so we're committed to that. And we know that whatever happens, whatever the weather holds, whatever time holds, whatever chance brings, across our path, we believe in God's purpose. And we're committed to it. And we're next to each other. Shouldn't your brothers and sisters know that about you? We need to know that about each other. And this was a city of people who knew that about one another. They were not a city of craftsmen. If we were to read through the list here again, we'd see that there's a priest that's working, verses 1 and 2. There's a goldsmith that's working. We've already referenced him. There's a man who mixes together spices and roots and extractions and makes perfume, ointments. And there's another man who is a politician, several men that were politicians. There's a man and his daughters who are working on the walls together, Shalem. And so these are not people that are experts. They're all amateurs, but they are committed amateurs in the work that they're doing. And God blesses the work that they do. And when they're done, after 52 days, after a month and a half, don't you know they have a city full of people that know something about building walls? They were inexperienced when they started, but they know something about it when it's done. And the same is true of us. There are no experts in the business of righteousness among us. We are all amateurs in the work that God has given us to do. We are all inexpert, but we've got a perfect book that informs us. And so that is reason for patience. It's reason, again, to be committed. Because God can do great things with people who love Him enough that they dare, that they try, that they work together, that they grow together in this great work. And God can make of us a city of people who know something about saving souls, a city of people who know something about growing in love, a city of people who know something about being forbearing, about being diligent, about being steadfast, about being virtuous, about being holy, about being humble and meek. And all of those values that are godly values that are recommended to us, that are modeled for us in the Lord Himself. You all are talented people. There are lots of great talents here. And there's wonderful demographics of youth and age and of the blending of those kinds of things. And there are all kinds of skills that you bring to the Lord's work. And every one of those, every skill that any one of you has is important to the work that's going on here. And everybody's important to that task. And the Lord calls us to bring all those gifts to His purpose and to employ those in the betterment of one another. And God will do great things with you if we all individually are committed to being next to each other and employed together in that kind of work. In the book of Revelation, there's a wonderful text where John talks about the reading of names from the book of life. He says, "I saw a great white throne," Revelation 20, verse 11, "and Him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away. No place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire." This is the second death, the lake of fire. "And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire." Think about those names in the book of life. And think about the reading of the names found in the book of life. You know, there'll be some that are familiar to us, that are like our names. There'll be a lot of names that are like Nehemiah chapter 3 that are totally unfamiliar to us. We've never heard them before. And when they hear our names, they'll sound weird to them because they're different. But can you imagine when that mass of people, the small and great, stand before the throne of God and God is reading the names? Don't you know that He will pronounce every one of them exactly the way they're to be pronounced? And can you imagine that there'll be any restlessness in the crowd when those names are being read, don't you know that every eye will be fixed on the throne and everyone will be listening for what name will be next? And maybe when a name is read, there'll be a little eruption, a little celebration, because it's somebody that we know, somebody from our time, somebody from our community, somebody from our body, and there'll be a little rejoicing when that name is read, when it's heard. And when we hear those names, when we hear our name, won't it be like that name has never been said before? You might have heard your name said beautifully by other people, but never, never will your name be said in a way that is more heartwarming, more soul-thrilling than when God identifies that He knows you, that He knows your name, that He remembers you the way that He remembered these people in Nehemiah chapter 3. My middle name is Frederick. I didn't like my middle name when I was growing up. I thought it sounded stuffy. But Frederick is my father's middle name. He's Rodney Frederick. Frederick is my Papa Moore. It's his first name. He's Frederick Robert. I like Frederick now because it's a connection to my dad and it's a connection to my granddad. If the Lord wants to call me Frederick on that day, that'll be just fine. And if He wants to call me by my first name, that'll be fine. If He wants to call me by my last name first and my first name, the way that you call roll, that'll be fine too. If the Lord just wants to say to me, "Hey you, get in here," that'll be okay too. But I want to say to you that there's one thing that I want more than I want my next breath. I want Him to know my name. I want my name to be written there. And there's a second thing that I want, and I really mean this, more than I want my next breath. I want your name to be written there too. Do you know that tonight? That if God reads the names of the book of life, that your name is recorded there. That He knows who you are the way that He knows who these people are. That He's remembered you because you've committed your life to Him. If you don't have that confidence tonight, won't you find that? Won't you have that? Won't you trust and won't you obey as we stand and as we sing for your encouragement?